I left you folks with a question yesterday, so let me remind you what the question was and then give you the answer. So we were talking yesterday about the thermofield double construction, and I wanted to consider the thermal density matrix for some field theory. And I said that what you could do is you could construct this thermal density matrix not on one Hilbert space, but consider a state, a pure state, in the tensor product Hilbert space, which is a double copy of your original Hilbert space, such that tracing out 1/2 gives you and I'll put indices left, right here just to indicate that the tracing over right and left gives you this guy. Okay, and the thermofield double state had an explicit expression in terms of energy eigenstates. And there are many ways to think about this. One way I like particularly, which is useful, is to think of the partition function z of beta, which is trace rho beta, as just the inner product of this thermofield double state with itself. You can check that this will indeed give you z of beta. And so one useful way to think about this thermofield double state is to imagine doing a Euclidean path integral over a thermal circle of size beta and cutting that thermal circle in half to construct the thermofield double state. So in pictures I had yesterday for you, this picture of space, Lorentzian time, And I had these circles, which was meant to represent Euclidean time, which was running around and had period beta. And all I'm asserting here is that if you do Euclidean evolution by an amount beta, but cut the evolution halfway through this picture so that you sort of keep the top, which is TE equals 0, and the antipodal point, which is TE equals beta over 2, then what you get when you cut this path integral, slice it in half, is exactly the thermofield double state. So it's an operational construction from a path integral perspective of how you build this thermofield double state. And the question I left you with yesterday is, how do we think about this holographically? What does this mean in holography? And just to say one more thing, once, so this z of beta defines a thermal free energy. So log of z of beta is minus beta times the free energy at temperature beta, inverse temperature beta. And the entropy, the thermal entropy at temperature T, which is 1 over beta, is just the von Neumann entropy of this reduced density, of this density matrix rho beta. So all of these are familiar facts. I'm just doing thermodynamics in a language that's sort of a bit finesse towards entanglement oriented discussion. The nice thing about doing thermodynamics is simply this Euclidean construction allowing us to interpret give us a path integral picture of what's going on. So we have this, and now this is a construction that you can do for any quantum field theory. I just want to ask, what does this mean if my quantum field theory happens to have a gravity dual? So I'll answer that question first by sort of reminding you of the algorithm we gave ourselves yesterday, that if you want to construct gravity duals to various situations with various boundary conditions, you just solve Einstein's equations subject to those boundary conditions. Now, to understand what we need to do, let me first convince you that the bulk theory I need to solve, I can sort of pretty much ignore all the details of the theory for the following simple reason. What I really want to compute is a path integral that gives me the partition function, which just has information about the spectrum of the theory. It tells me how many operators there are and what the energies is. This guy doesn't really care about what the operators are. It's just a counting problem. It just enumerates. So I just need something that knows about energies. I don't care how those energies are organized in different quantum numbers. So in terms of quantum numbers, I'm going to keep track of only one quantum number, the energy quantum number, which means that in the gravitational theory, I can forget about the details of various operators that are various fields that are dual to all the operators in the theory and keep track of the one operator that counts the energy. But I told you what that is, that the energy in the field theory is counted by the energy momentum tensor, and the dual picture of the energy momentum tensor is just the gravitons. So insofar as understanding what the answer to this question is in gravity, I can simplify my gravitational problem significantly by saying, forget about all the gravitational fields except the gravitational field itself. Forget about all the matter fields. Forget about everything that propagates in areas. Just keep track of the gravitational field. So we should be able to compute Z of beta. By just looking at the gravitational theory, the dynamics of gravitons. We truncate the bulk dynamics. To dynamics of pure gravity. So in other words, I should be able to compute Z of beta by computing e to the minus, the on-shell, the string partition function in the full string theory with boundary conditions that there is a circle parameterized by TE of period beta. Everything else is irrelevant for this problem. And of course, we are going to compute this by approximating this by the gravitational path integral. So this is computed, technically speaking, by doing a functional integral in the gravitational theory, by doing a functional integral over the space of all matrix. For some action involving the string. And I have implicitly assumed that at the end of the day, since I'm having Euclidean time, I can do the Euclidean computation. So e to the is has become e to the minus s. Good. And this, the further simplification I'm going to assume, is that this can be evaluated as e to the minus on-shell action of gravity. And I gravity is the action of coming from the action of our favorite gravitational theory, which is just Einstein-Hilbert theory. Okay, lambda, if you want me to be precise, is d times d minus 1. is given by just some number times the area length scale. This last statement is the only statement where I'm assuming a saddle point evaluation. I'm assuming that this makes sense as C as the central charge, effective central charge goes to infinity. And I'll define the effective central charge as follows. It's a dimensionless number, so I'll just define it to be this quantity. It just keeps equations later simpler. Okay, so we have our problem. We're going to have to solve Einstein's equations with those given boundary conditions. So I'll do the problem in two steps. First, I'll do it for a simple case, and then for a more complicated case, and you will see the distinction in the two cases. So the first case I'm going to study is I'll take my field theory, which is a conformal field theory in d dimensions, on Minkowski space. At temperature beta. And to do this, I can equivalently say this is to considering the Euclidean conformal field theory on Rd minus 1 times S1 with size beta. Okay, that's this picture. Except that now just upgrade this plane up here to a copy of Minkowski space. Okay? Same picture, just saying the same words. So what are the solutions? Well, I just want to find solutions to this action that have a circle parameterized by Euclidean time. And they're plane symmetric. They have planar symmetry in d minus 1 dimensions. So I can write down an ansatz, very easy ansatz, just following all the symmetries. So let's parameterize this as follows. So this is just convention. I'm just going to put these factors out front because it makes life easier later. So there's some function in the time-time component. There's some function in the radial direction. And I have chosen to fix gauge for the space-time, I have to fix coordinates. I've chosen to fix those coordinates such that the size of these spatial directions in d minus 1 dimensions is just set to be 1 over z squared. Okay, that's the choice that I've made. Just simplifies the equations. Okay, so you have the action. You have whose equations of motion are just Einstein's equations. So Einstein's equations with those conventions for lambda, they simply are sorry, my convention was this was Latin, so let me fix that. Okay. So now it's a matter of taking this metric, figuring out your favorite way to compute the Ricci tensor, which you can pretty much do by hand in this case, or if you feel so inclined, you can use various software packages that are available. But you have two differential equations that you have to solve for f and g. But before I solve for f and g, let me give you some intuition. Oh, sorry, I'm still finding the Euclidean solution, so this should be plus and this should be te. Sorry. Okay. So I'm still solving for the Euclidean solution. And I've used the fact that thermodynamics is static, so I can just work with the Euclidean geometry. That was the intuition behind that. Okay. Now, but before I tell you what the solution is, let me say what can happen. Well, this x space is doing nothing. Okay, it's just going along for the ride because I've gauge fixed it totally. But this circle has size, some size on the boundary. I want its boundary size measured by the boundary observer to be beta. That's the temperature felt by the field theory. So there are two possibilities. One is the circle sort of shifts around, it sort of its proper size changes as a function of the z coordinate, but it always stays a finite circle. It doesn't pinch off. A second possibility is as you go in z from z equals 0, which is the boundary, into the area spacetime, this circle pinches off somewhere. These are two topological possibilities that we could sort of say that without doing any work. In other words, the topology in the TEZ plane is either that of a disk where the circle shrinks to zero at the center of the disk, or is just that of a circle times a line. I belabor this point because it's actually useful for the next problem I'm going to do, and later when I come to the entanglement entropies. So let me call it B2, which is a two ball, a disk. So I have TE running around like this, and Z coming in that way, and the circle shrinks to zero some locus, or it just like so, where its topology is that of a cylinder. Okay, so I don't mean to draw it sort of rigidly, it could sort of have some profile, but let's just leave it at that. Okay, but that's all you can say without doing any work. Now one has to do some work to solve the equations, but the equations are reasonably easy to solve. Here are solutions. The thing that has topology of this circle times line is actually the thing that you already know. It's a solution where f of z and g of z are both 1. In fact, it's what I actually drew, just a rigid cylinder, nothing happens. And this solution we know from before, it's just the ADS solution with time analytically continued and made periodic with period beta. So this is what I will call the Euclidean ADS solution with TE having period beta in this geometry. There's a more interesting solution. So this has topologies, this has topology of S1 beta times R. Second solution, which has topology of the two ball, is F of Z equals also G of Z, the way I've written it. These functions have simple zeros at some locus z equals z plus. Okay? That has the topology of this. Actually, let me redraw this picture to make it sort of a bit more similar to this. So imagine that instead of sort of looking at the circle shrinking to zero like this, I sort of pull this out, pull out the origin like a balloon. So then it looks like a cigar where the circle, now this is z, instead of being a radial direction, and this is TE. Okay. So the circle has finite size, comes in, pinches off. Okay, so that's what's happening here. I've drawn it in a manner that presages the answer. I want, as I reminded you, smooth solutions, otherwise I'll have to mistrust my gravitational equations. To end up having something smooth, I need this circle, the TE circle, to pinch off smoothly, and that gives me a relation between beta and z plus. So this was part of the exercise yesterday. I won't do this exercise now, but smoothness gives you that beta is 4 pi, z plus over d. Sorry. This is the other way around, actually, if you work everything out. Yeah. It's 4 pi L area squared over dz plus. Okay, so this you can work out essentially by demanding that this point where this circle shrinks to zero looks like the origin in polar coordinates. That was the exercise that I asked you to do yesterday in a simpler example, but that's all we have. Okay, so we have two solutions. We have to decide which of them is the correct one. We have two saddle points to the action. I need to know which one is right. So to understand which solution dominates, the saddle point evaluation, we compute the on-shell action, and this is sounds like a mouthful, but it's a very simple object. You take the solution, you plug it back in here. I have to dress this up with some boundary terms to make sure that the action actually converges. The boundary terms are written down for you in the, I can write them down. So S gravity, the true S gravity that you want, is S bulk, which is given there, plus S boundary. And this S boundary is 1 over 8 pi g. Integral of the extrinsic curvature plus finite counter terms. Okay. These are required for convergence. This is required for variational principle. But never mind what these are. This is some details of what the gravitational theory wants us to do. What you find when the dust settles, you find that this solution always dominates. It has the smaller action, so it is the dominant saddle point for this problem. This solution does not dominate ever in this configuration. And I'll just give you the intuitive reason why this must be true. This solution is just ADS spacetime with time compactified. We argued that the ADS spacetime is like the vacuum of the theory. So if I'm doing thermal physics, if all I have is a vacuum, then I'm never going to see any interesting thermal physics. I'm not going to see any interesting spectral data. Okay? It's a slightly fast argument because later on I'm going to tell you something exactly opposite, but keep this in mind. And this solution looks genuine. It looks like it has some information about what's happening in the spectrum. And if you compute so this beta is given here, this temperature is given here. If you compute the entropy, S of t, for this solution, you get t to the d minus 1 times the volume of the x space. Yes? It's just ADS periodic with time, Euclidean time periodically identified. That's correct. It just turns out in this case it doesn't dominate. I was just going to about to give you the reason for it. You can think of it that way, but I'm going to give you the reason why that's the case. And if I put in the factors, you'll find that the factor here is C effective. Actually, 4 pi C effective in my conventions. This is the right answer for the entropy of a d-dimensional conformal field theory. Okay? So even if you didn't know aspect of gravity, if you asked yourself what is the thermal entropy of a field of a theory that has conformal invariance, entropy is extensive in spatial volume. A conformal field theory has no scales. I turned on a temperature, which means I put in an energy scale, which is the thermal scale. So the only way I can get a dimensionless number is multiplying temperature to the right power with the spatial volume to get an extensive entropy. One piece of data I don't know is the coefficient. That coefficient turns out in this case to be the central charge as I defined it. It's not the true central charge of the theory, but it's some measure of the thermal degrees of freedom in the system. Okay. So this is a sort of slick hand-waving argument to give you this answer. The key point is this solution gives you that answer. What does that solution look like? Well, I already told you what it looks like in Euclidean space. It looks like a cigar because the time circle, the Euclidean time circle shrinks to zero. But now, since time is a killing direction, I can write down the corresponding Lorentzian solution. You all probably know the answer. This is a black hole solution in the Lorentzian signature. And I'll draw for you the Penrose diagram that you saw in the GR lecture last week for the solution. So the maximally extended Penrose diagram for this solution looks as follows. And I have my CFT, one copy of the CFT, which I'll call the right CFT out this way. I'll call this boundary the left. The solution has two Lorentzian boundaries separated by a black hole horizon. A singularity is about in, so it's a small detail that you can ask me why later. And the Euclidean circle that I drew before runs along like this. Okay, it's coming out of the board. So this is the plane. This is the Lorentzian plane. The Euclidean circle is sort of going in and out of the board. And that circle direction you can think of as going out that way. So this, you can think of this CFT as having TE equals 0. This CFT having TE equals beta over 2, and then the Euclidean time runs counterclockwise out of the board, back into the board. Sorry, clockwise if you're looking from up. There is a special surface here, the horizon, which is the bifurcation surface. This is a locus z equals z plus t equals 0, and this is the locus where in the Euclidean picture, the boundary has the circle. This circle comes in and shrinks to 0, and then regrows back. Okay. So the disk that I drew before is the plane of this Euclidean disk. So the origin of that Euclidean disk is this point. Now, you all also know that black holes have thermodynamic properties. And in this case, the entropy that I computed from the partition function calculation, you can interpret as the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of this black hole. But that guy is something very simple. It's the area of this bifurcation surface. I'm going to give it a name. I'm going to call it curly E for reasons that will become clear in a while. It's the area of E in units of Newton's constant. Okay? So there's a special surface in this geometry. And let's just count how many dimensions that surface has. It's a point on this plane. It's a locus given by two equations, z equals something and t equals something. So it's two dimensions lower than the parent spacetime, I will use the word codimension 2 to denote such surfaces. So the bifurcation surface E is a codimension 2 surface. It has one special property, which I will say in a moment. If you're wondering what the word bifurcation surface means, it just means that the killing field d by dt, the Lorentzian killing field, it's a vector field. This vector field is identically zero on this surface. Okay, I put the index just to denote it's a vector field. And this is codimension 2. In the space-time, okay? So space-time is my notation from yesterday, md plus 1. So it's a d minus 1 dimensional surface in d plus 1 dimensional space-time. Yeah? Good. So the question was, usually there's a Lorentzian time direction which is going up and down. But I also have this thing that circulates around. So I'm drawing a lot of information for you on that Penrose diagram. So usually when people draw Penrose diagram, they just draw the Lorentzian geometry. Okay? And in the Lorentzian geometry, you're quite right that the Lorentzian time for this guy runs up, whereas the Lorentzian time for this guy runs down. Remember the thermofield double Hamiltonian was h right minus h left. The thermofield double state was a zero energy state of h right minus h left from yesterday. Okay. So this is the symmetry. You can sort of move this. You can go this way as long as you compensate this way. If you try to go up the Penrose diagram, that's not a symmetry. Okay. But I'm also including extra information by using the fact that there's a Euclidean time direction which circulates around this picture. Okay? And I've drawn the Euclidean time only in the t equals 0 slice because that's the easy thing to do. Okay? So I have sort of blown up the Penrose diagram, if you like, by drawing the plane, which is the usual Penrose diagram, but also added for you an extra circle, which is the Euclidean direction, just to give you contact with the previous picture I had in some sense. So I had this picture where I had space, Lorentzian time, and this Euclidean circle. Now I've sort of tilted that on its side, and now the Lorentzian time is running up. It's not running back into the board, but the Euclidean time is running back into the board. Whenever it doesn't say TE, it's a Lorentzian field. I put the index explicitly to make sure that I'm talking about TE. Yeah? There's nothing special about TE equals 0, but the picture is most clean on that slice. If I want to draw another TE, I have to respect this up-down symmetry. Now, if I want to sort of draw another slice in the Euclidean plane by time translating, so I've fixed an origin for the Lorentzian time and then analytically continued. But of course, nothing depends on Lorentzian time. I could time translate it and then analytically continue. If I did that, I'd have to draw the circle sort of going this way. You know, because the orbits are going opposite. In other words, the Euclidean circle, the Euclidean disk, never intersects that singularity. It's very important. The Euclidean disk always has this fixed point locus. It always has this fixed point locus. The Euclidean time in every slicing of this geometry shrinks to zero at z equals z plus. Because you see, it doesn't know, the Euclidean geometry doesn't know about what's happening elsewhere. Okay, so that's one reason I didn't draw it more. Okay, so this is very nice. So we have an answer, we have a geometry, we have an interpretation, and we see something nice. That we thought that this thermal entropy was the von Neumann entropy of the density matrix rho beta. I'm giving you a map between the von Neumann entropy of the thermal density matrix and area of some surface. Okay? This density matrix for the density matrix for the entire right CFT, but never mind. This is the answer. This is the answer we've known for roughly 40 years, and this picture of thinking about this eternal planar black hole in this language is due to Israel and Maldacena from Israel from mid-70s and Maldacena from early 2000s. Okay? Questions about this? Yeah? Is it obvious it's a thermofield double? Well, it sort of is in the sense that the time translate, the Lorentzian time, in the thermofield double state, let me just write it down again. Had a pairing between the left and right energy eigenstates, and it was annihilated by this operator H right tensor, identity left minus identity right minus times H left. These killing orbits of time going up and down give you the relative sign. It's stationary with respect to that killing time. So it has all the right features. You're asking a more detailed question, which is, can I see the energy eigenstates? And that answer is no, because all you're seeing is a sort of just the result for superposing all those energy eigenstates with the right Boltzmann weights. So you can think of this as the gravitational dual of the thermal density matrix on mass, not of the individual states. Okay, so that was problem number one. I'm going to do problem number two, which is the same thing, but now I'm going to put my theory on a sphere just to illustrate one funny feature. Okay, so nothing changes really. I replace all R's by S's. There's a sphere of fixed size. I replace the flat metric by the metric on a round sphere. I have same ansatz. Actually, let me just remove this factor for now. And change coordinates a little bit just to make things a bit nicer. Small details, nothing really changed. I'm doing the same thing, but just calling things differently, calling coordinates R, not Z, just to keep my internal notation consistent. See, now something interesting happens. Just again, same argument vis-a-vis topologies. Again, in the TR plane, I can have the disk topology. Actually, now let me put the sphere as well, because something interesting can happen with the sphere. Either, same thing as before pertains, I get a disk times a d minus 1 sphere topologically. That is, the time circle, which is a circle, shrinks to 0, but the spatial sphere, which is a sphere, just stays put. It sort of changes size a little bit, but doesn't do anything. So in other words, I have this kind of picture where this is TE still. Now this is R. R runs from 0 at this tip now, or some value to R equals infinity at the boundary. I've just switched things around. And then I have some sphere which sort of stays some, whose size changes. I've changed coordinates, its size changes with R. But it's not doing very much. But there's another topology that's possible, where the circle doesn't shrink, but the sphere gets filled in. sphere gets filled into a ball. Life might be simpler if you think of not a sphere, but think of this D equals 2, when this is also a circle. I have two circles. You can sort of think of the boundary as a two torus, and then you can fill the two torus into a donut, but you have two choices of which way you're going to fill in the two torus into a donut, either along the spatial circle or along the temporal circle. Okay. The end result is still a donut, but it's a question of what you call what. Okay. So anyway, there are two topologies. One still has to find the solution. And here are the solutions. For the second case, where I have the ball, these guys are exactly what you expect from before. If this ball shrinks to 0, then this function f can't shrink to 0. So I have the function f and g being the same. They're just 1 plus r squared over L ADS squared. What you again get is the Euclidean ADS geometry, but now in global coordinates. The non-trivial solution, the second solution where, so this is the topology S1 times ball. The topology where I have a 2-ball times SD minus 1 is the new guy that we haven't seen before. It's 1 plus. It starts out the same way, but then gets corrected with a new term, which I'm going to parameterize in some form as follows. Okay, the function f of r and g of r are given by this. They're the global ADS function with a new power law correction. And I've parameterized this power law correction such that there is a simple 0 at r equals r plus. Okay, that's my parameterization. This is the global Schwarzschild ADS geometry. And now life is much more interesting than the previous case. Much, much more interesting because of the following two facts. First, we can ask, when is this solution regular? Okay. And you can convince yourself that I'll write the answer, that the temperature has to be aligned with this parameter r plus for that to happen. And I won't write out the expression. It's a bit uglier, but you can work it out. It just temperature is derivative of this function at its simple 0 divided by 4 pi. Very simple. Okay. Okay. Let me plot for you this temperature. You will see something very interesting. This is this temperature as a function of r plus. It's not single value. Two-lobed function. Temperature increases with r plus on one side. Temperature increases with decreasing r plus on the other side. There's a minimum. And solutions don't exist below some critical temperature. So without doing a calculation, I can tell you that only for temperatures above this value are we even going to have a hope of this solution being dominant. I don't have to do a calculation to check if it's dominant. It just doesn't exist for lower temperatures. So for small enough temperatures, there's a unique solution in the game given by this guy, the Euclidean ADS solution. So earlier I was asked, what happens? Can't I just take the Euclidean ADS solution? In the previous case, it was there. It never was the dominant saddle point. In the present case, it is there, and it definitely is the only saddle point for temperatures below TC. But it's a boring solution. It just anti-de-Sitter space with time identified. It has nothing going on. It has zero energy because the same energy as the ground state and has no entropy. So entropy in this solution, let me write zero and put quotation marks around the zero. I will fix that in a bit. It's a bizarre solution. You've heated up a conformal field theory, it's interacting, it's strongly coupled, and you get zero entropy. This solution, which exists for temperatures above, has an entropy S of T, which is a bit more complicated, but you can work out what S of T is as in terms of R plus of T, it's R plus to the D minus 1 of T. C effective. Okay, it's proportional to this fact. I'll just write it like this. It's a bit messy to write out the expression, but it's just the same answer as before. It just is Bekenstein-Hawking formula. So since there is a horizon at R equals R plus, it's a sphere is of size R plus. It's a D minus one sphere, so I get R plus to the D minus one. It's the volume of that sphere. Great. So what's going on here? This is a solution that seems sensible. This is a solution that has no entropy. And the second solution, for all intents and purposes, looks like this, for what I've drawn, because I suppressed all the spatial directions. So the geometry, the Penrose diagram, everything basically is the same thing. It doesn't matter, really. So this is the same for planar or global. So I don't need to redraw this picture. And let me emphasize one thing, that in both solutions, you see that the ADS metric is corrected here by a power of z to the d. Here it's corrected by a power of r to the d minus 2, which is 1 over r to the d relative to the leading r squared falloff. So in both cases, if you go back to my expression from last time where I told you the energy is the leading asymptotic falloff with coefficient r to the d or z to the d, that's what. So these pieces here and this piece here measure the energy of the state relative to the vacuum. So the boundary energy momentum tensor in this case is parameterized by the one variable we have, R plus. Here it's parameterized by Z plus. And in both cases it makes sense because I've heated up the theory to some temperature, so the energy should be also given by the value of the temperature. In fact, you can just work it out from thermodynamics. You know, entropy as a function of temperature. So you can just work out what the energy of the function of temperature is from using the first law, dE equals TdS. It's a conformal field theory. Energy goes like Stefan Boltzmann value T to the d. Right? So what's going on here? This solution makes ample sense for us. It's in accord with our intuition that, again, entanglement is being this entanglement in the thermal density matrix is being captured by some kind of black hole entropy. Same similar surface, except that this E is now a sphere, not a copy of a plane, so on and so forth. But who ordered this solution? And why did this second solution not exist for all ranges of parameters? The answer, it turns out, has to do with what can happen for a interacting theory in finite volume. So we have here a field theory, in the second example, on a spatial sphere. So the spatial volume is being made compact. And I don't know how familiar are people with the following fact, that usually you would have said, in compact space, you cannot have phase transitions because there is no thermodynamic limit. We are, however, working in compact space, but with the C effective, which is some rough measure of our degrees of freedom, being taken large. So we are attaining secretly a thermodynamic limit, not by decompactifying space, but by ramping up the number of degrees of freedom. Okay? Ergo, we can, in principle, have large N phase, large C effective phase transitions simply because of the thermodynamic limit. The free energy does not have to be analytic in the large C effective limit, and this is the first signal that something is going on there. Okay? So the free energy is not analytic in this example, and you have a phase transition. This phase transition was discovered by Stephen Hawking and Don Page about a decade and a half before ADS-CFT. It's named after them. It's called the Hawking-Page transition. But it was interpreted in this language by Ed Witten. And I can sort of fix this expression now by saying that all of this is an artifact of us wanting to do large C effective. If we honestly try to compute the low energy, low temperature entropy for this state, we should not get zero, but we should get zero plus something of order one. In other words, if you're doing an asymptotic expansion in C effective, the entropy should always take the form I will write it as this, C effective times some S saddle plus S quantum plus order 1 over C effective. I'm not saying anything very profound here. This is just a statement of doing asymptotics with some one large parameter, which is C effective. Okay, there's some saddle point. The saddle point is solution is accurate when this guy is large. But if this guy is not large, you have to worry about the one loop determinant around the saddle, and that will give you the quantum corrections. So in this case, for the thermal case, thermal ADS, you can work out what this quantum entropy is if you did fluctuations around the thermal ADS point. So S quantum is basically obtained by doing one loop fluctuations about the saddle. And you do get a finite answer if you go through the calculation in the ADS joint. Yes? No, I have separated out the quantum correction, the higher order pieces. So the one loop determinant will just give you something of order one in the way I'm doing saddle points. There'll be subleading corrections which are two loop, three loop, so on and so forth. I'm just dropping all of them. Okay? Yes? That will work out at the end of the day, and I can tell you roughly why. It's just that ADS is a harmonic trap. So you basically get roughly, again, the same number of degrees of freedom for the oscillations as there are on the boundary. So if you go through the exercise of the harmonic trap, you will see exactly this. Because I won't do the calculation, but trust me, it works. Yes? Okay, so the entropy is always extensive, but the point is I'm sort of decomposing the entropy into two pieces. Three pieces, really. There's a temperature dependence, which is pretty much fixed by extensivity. There's a volume dependence, which is also fixed. I haven't written it here, but I should have written it as the volume of the sphere, right, because it's the same volume factor. But then there is a prefactor, numerical prefactor, if you like, function of number of degrees of freedom. That's the part I'm focusing on because that's what controls the saddle. The volume and the temperature don't control the saddle. Yeah. So as I told you, the C effective was like h bar, right? Was like 1 over h bar. So this is a 1 over h bar contribution. This is an order 1 contribution. And then the order h bar contributions, which I'm ignoring. So that's how I'm organizing this expansion. OK. We are almost there. I'll pause here to ask if there are questions, because I am pretty much at a point where I can now motivate Dhruta Kainani. Great. So here we are. We have this very simple example. This example was known, as I said, late 90s. But then I'm going to interpret this sort of post-Ryuta Kainagi a la Mark Ramsdonk, and then come back and give you the Ryuta Kainagi story. Yes, Patrick.
Actually, I was just wondering, the units of that entropy, you have length to the power of B minus 1 2 times. What about the universe?
Let's say my sphere is a unit sphere, so there's no length here. I'll put an LADS here if you're happier. So it's a volume, it's just some ratio of gamma, it's just gamma pi's and gamma functions. So really measure, so measure L in units, R plus in units of LADS. That's a dimensionless number, then you're fine. Everything is dimensionless now. Thank you. Okay, so let me give you the interpretation a la Van Ramsdonk. So the statement is the following. So S beta was supposed to be minus rho beta log rho beta trace. And this is the dominant order C effective contribution of S is contained in a geometric construct which is this bifurcation surface E. Because I was trying to do some computation field theory, and I got an answer which told me, go and look at the area of this surface E. Just interpreting the answer at this point, not trying to give you a derivation. But quantum connections are more mysterious because they require due to fluctuations. But you could say the following, that if you have sufficient entanglement between the left and right CFT, then you build up some geometry with this new surface E, which knows about the entanglement. So I'm going to give it this sort of heuristic interpretation, which will then allow me to motivate Ryuta Kainagi backwards. So macroscopic entropy in the semi-classical limit is geometry. And moreover, I can look at this geometry, look at sections at constant T slash TE, where this geometry looks like R and I can draw a picture for you of embedding this part of the geometry in some higher dimensional space. Okay, I'm taking a section, and I'm just going to go from here through here to here. And I'm going to draw a picture for you just to illustrate what's going on. What I have in this picture is some geometric construct where I have, let's say, an SD minus 1 going around, and this is the radial direction. And there is some critical surface, which is which, as I said, is codimension 2. So this is my E, which is an SD minus 1 itself, which is a sort of bottleneck for communication from this side to this side, if I look at a constant time section. So those of you who were at Matt Hedrick's talk last week, he was talking about this max cut mean flow and interpreting things in terms of bit threads. So if I think of trying to construct the thermofield double by thinking of entangling stuff on this boundary with entangling stuff on that boundary by sort of building up EPR-like pairs, I have a bottleneck where I can pack in most number of threads through the middle, and that bottleneck is this surface. Okay? So at this point, there was something purely geometric, and the area of this E, which is the area of the bottleneck, is giving us the thermal entropy, or I'm happily interpreting that as the von Neumann entropy of the density matrix rho beta. One final fact, which I will need for later purposes, you can ask me, what is special about the surface E? What distinguishes the surface E from any other codimension 2 surface in this spacetime? In this case, this surface sits in this picture at a moment of time symmetry. As I told you, it's a locus where a killing field goes to zero. This surface is an extremal surface. In fact, it's a bit more than an extremal surface, but let me say it this way. For now, it's at least an extremal surface. Let me call it extremal codimension 2 surface. And what that means is that if I think of it embedded, it's a surface which has two lower dimensions than my parent spacetime, I can try to look at how the surface is bending in the two orthogonal directions, in its normal plane. Okay, so you can think of how E bends in the TR plane, say. Right? Because the surface is just a sphere. It's just parameterized by the angles. And the extremality condition simply says that that bending motion doesn't cost anything locally. It doesn't bend. It's sort of extremal in that sense. There's a nice way to say this. If you shoot light rays away from E, they locally neither expand nor contract. And strictly speaking, that's the definition of something extreme. So imagine in four dimensions, you have a two sphere, and from every point on the two sphere, you try to shine out light rays, both out from the two sphere and into the two sphere. Okay. In meaning radially inward, out meaning radially outward. Now, usually your two sphere, if you're sort of sitting on a two sphere in flat space and you're shining light out, the light that goes from the in the outward direction expands. You build a bigger two sphere. When you go inward, you build a smaller two sphere, those light rays contract because then they coalesce to the point, the origin. This sphere is a special sphere. You try sending light out, nothing happens. Try sending light in, nothing happens. In fact, this sphere is really special. The light rays that are going out from here are along this blue line. They are along the horizon. Every cross-section of this horizon has the same area. Okay? So this is property of staticity. Nothing happens in this case. the inward going light ray sort of will eventually start contracting because inside this is the black hole, this is where everything is being attracted to the singularity. But locally, the infinitesimal set of light rays don't expand or contract. That's what this distinguishes this particular two sphere, this particular codimension two surface from any other codimension two surface you could have drawn on this Penrose diagram. You can convince yourself it's unique in this case. Yeah. There's a formula for this, which I'll write down for you. I can say that this says that the expansion theta plus theta minus of the light rays is 0. And I'll define this theta plus and theta minus as follows. So E is codimension 2, which means that it has two normals. I'm going to draw it like this. A codimension 2 surface on a plane is a point. So let me talk about the normals n plus and n minus. I'm aligning them to light rays, so it's sort of clear that I'm drawing them at 45 degrees in this picture. And these n plus dot n plus is 0, n minus dot n minus is 0. And if you wish, you can even normalize them relative to each other. You can normalize them such that their inner product, combined inner product, gives you the time-like direction. So they're vectors in space-time. I can define extrinsic curvatures for the surface as the covariant derivative of this guy, then I'll of these normals, but then I project down that covariant derivative back to the surface. Okay. So I'm pretending these are space-time vectors. At the end of the day, I only care about the vectors sitting on the surface. So I compute them with all their components and then project down to the surface. That's what this projection means. And then the theta plus minus are basically trace K in the on the surface. Okay. So you have two simple equations for what the surface is in space-time. Yes? For static, for stationary black hole geometries.
So
it's a unique fixed, so bifurcation surface for me was the fixed point of the killing field.
Yeah.
There's a unique point of that killing field. This equation may have more solutions.
Yeah.
And this geometry especially enough that it doesn't have that freedom. Yes. Thank you. Any other questions? Yes. Yes. There is a reason. Can I postpone that for later? It's just that, okay, there's an intuitive reason. Think of your Schwarzschild Penrose diagram in flat space. Boundaries are light-like, singularity is straight. Now try to make the boundaries time-like, flatten them in. You have to bow the singularities down. Okay. So you can sort of work this out by trying to send light rays from here to the singularity and seeing that they bounce back on the other side. So you can show that there's no square Penrose diagram you can draw by just looking at how the properties of light rays. Yeah, that's a short answer. There's a longer story how to see why it's the case, but okay. So this was Marx's interpretation, and I'm just giving you lots of details of how to think about the surface, because now I can for free tell you how the Ryutaka-Inagi and the covariant generalization of it by Veronica, myself, and Tadashi works, because I just tell you the following set of words. Forget about constructing density matrices for the entire boundary. Let's start doing the following. So take your CFT in some state. Let me call it the global state. Let's call that rho. Could be pure, it could be mixed, I don't care at this point. Okay. So as various people have pointed out, what we do in holography is sort of slight abuse of language as far as entanglement entropy is concerned, because we compute things that's just one Neumann entropy may not be quite entanglement. Okay, so we take this, and then on the CFT, pick some region which I like to call A on a Cauchy slice. Sigma. Okay? So picture is this. So I have this is a time slice of my field theory. I'm thinking of putting down the state. The state exists at a moment of time. I can Heisenberg evolve it, but let me not do that. And there is some region A. And the complementary region, I'll call A complement. And I'll call the boundary of this region A, the entangling surface, dA. Just one simple counting of data. Cauchy surface is a time slice, so it's one dimension lower than the CFT. So sigma is d minus 1. A is just this entire volume, so A is also d minus 1 dimensional surface. dA is d minus 2. So this entangling surface is codimension 2 on the boundary. It'll be important in a while. For now, it's just a fact. Okay? Given this setup, you can go back to Horacio's lectures and say, okay, you gave me the state rho. I want to talk about the reduced state on A obtained by tracing out the stuff in A complement. And once I have this reduced state, I am free to compute its one Neumann entropy . Okay, I'm sloppy, my logs become LNs and logs. High energy theories, it's all base E, so it doesn't matter. Okay? So I want to compute SA. That's the data we want to compute. Okay? Previously we had rho was obtained by thermofield double construction. It was in two copies of the field theory, the Hilbert space was two copies of my field theory. And then I traced out one copy and got rho right. But now I'm just doing this for subregions. Okay, so the question is there a geometric construct that computes SA for us? And is there a geometric region that I can associate with rho A? These are the two questions I want to answer for you now. So, about a decade ago, Ryu and Takayanagi and then a while later, the covariant picture says that you compute SA by the following object. It's the area of some bulk codimension 2 surface, EA, in units of 4 g Newton. And let me write this as 4 pi c effective area. And I'm going to put in some conditions in front, that's why I've left some space. And I'm going to clear this out to write more conditions that follow afterwards, where this EA is an extremal surface in the sense I just erased. That is, if you shine light rays from it locally, they neither expand nor contract. And, or in other words, you can think of it as extremizing the area functional. And it's anchored on the entangling surface and homologous to it. By which I mean that there exists some space like surface RA whose only boundaries are EA and partial A. Let me draw a picture which should illustrate what's going on. I can draw it here. So, EA is like a soap bubble that's sort of stuck onto this boundary region. It extremizes its area. It really is a soap bubble. Gravity is pulling it down in ADS. It doesn't want to go further down. One second, huh? And what I mean by homologous is that you can sort of contract the surface back to the region A without encountering any obstacles. There are no holes in the middle. That's what this picture says. If I draw a slice of it, so this is A. This is EA. And this is RA. And these edges are the entangling surface. Yes, there was a question. Can you hold on to that thought for a bit? I'll answer that question. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Could I repeat it? No. Yes. This guy and this guy. RA is codimension 1. It should have been boundary of A, yes. No, it should have been A. Sorry, my fault. Yes, thank you. This is codimension 2. It's the right dimensions. Thank you. OK. So I'll come back to your question about what happens if there's an obstruction in the bulk. But I put this 4 pi c effective here. And it's not just this. Someone asked me earlier whether this is about uniqueness. It may be that there are multiple solutions. So you're instructed to take the infimum over all such surfaces, which is why I left space out here. So you take the one which smallest area. There are multiple solutions. And as we saw in our black hole case, this is just the leading answer in C effective. There's an order one piece, which I will write as S quantum. And I will explain what S quantum is in a bit. Questions? So Now let me explain S quantum and then come back to explaining what the homology constraint meant. To explain S quantum, I want to explain what is the natural bulk region that I should associate with rho A first. To do that, let me remind you of this fact. dA is codimension 2 on the boundary, which means that it's like this point in the boundary. What a codimension 2 surface does for you in Lorentzian spacetime is that it divides your spacetime into four regions. A point in Minkowski space does exactly this, the origin. It gives you the future of the point. So this is a point P. It gives you the future and past. And then it gives you space like right and space like left. But I can sort of extend this. Let me extend this in the case when A is just an interval so that you sort of see dA being sort of two points. So I'm imagining I'm in 1 plus 1 dimensions. I've sort of blown up this, so I have a bit more freedom. So I have one region in here. This is these two points are dA. The diamond in the middle is what I call the domain of dependence of A. It's a domain where you can think of rho A and Heisenberg evolve it by unitaries. Okay? Just initial, think of it a classical problem. I can lay down initial conditions here, and any hyperbolic equation can be evolved within that domain, within this diamond. This piece was A complement, and this corresponding domain is domain of dependence of A complement. Okay, I've just uncompactified this. If you like to compactify this, you can compactify this. And this W-shaped wedge on the top is a future of these two points. And this M-shaped region at the bottom is the past of these two points. So any codimension 2 surface gives you a decomposition of your spacetime into four domains. It's future and past, and two space-like regions, which I've now called dA and dA complement. Now, you can do manipulations inside here, but if you think of all those manipulations as acting with unitaries on rho A, they can't change SA. This SA is invariant under unitary rotations of rho A. Likewise, if you do unitaries in here, nothing is going to happen because that part is cancels out in the trace under A complement. So you hear the words entanglement entropy being associated with the region. Strictly speaking, you should think of entanglement entropy on the density matrix as being associated with this whole diamond. Because you can sort of do whatever you want within the diamond by unitaries. You can sort of, at least the entanglement entropy is invariant inside this diamond, a point that Horacio made in his lectures. So I need a corresponding decomposition in the bulk. And I sort of have it because in the bulk, this extremal surface, the Ryu-Takanagi surface, is codimension 2. So given the boundary decomposition, we have the corresponding bulk decomposition where I have EA is codimension 2, and I can write the bulk as the union of four regions, the future of EA. I'll put tildes to indicate that these are bulk futures, the past of EA, And now I need two of these space-like regions, and they are going to be defined by the domain of dependence of this surface that interpolated between E and boundary, and the corresponding domain of dependence for the complementary region for A complement. So I'm not going to redraw the picture, but just imagine that you replace this with E and the same picture holds. This domain is what various of us have called the entanglement wedge of A. So you carve out of the space-time four domains, four causal domains around this extremal surface, and one of them is the entanglement wedge of A. And now I can write out this quantum correction term. It's S quantum for the decomposition of the bulk into RA. Let me write it this way. It's rho bulk on RA. Okay. So in this picture, A complement was everything else. RA is sort of inside. I'm suppressing time. And the bulk state inside that RA defines some reduced density matrix. And if you compute the bulk quantum theory entanglement for that reduced density matrix, that gives you this quantum correction. It's precisely the statement we had before, that we had to do quantum fluctuations around the black hole solution or around a thermal ADS solution to get the 1 over C effective statements. So this part of the statement is Ryu Takayanagi or HRT. This part of the statement you can is attributed to Faulkner, Lefkowitz, and Maldacena, who derived this a few years ago as in the context of understanding how to prove the Ryu Takayanagi proposal from using a path integral. If time permitted, I was going to go through the derivation of that proof, but I think I will not do that, given that we're almost out of time. So I just want to make sure that people are happy about this, the set of statements, and then I'm going to answer the question if there aren't any others about what I just said. Yeah? Correct. So thank you, Zhao Liang, for that question. So I'll draw a bulk picture. So this is a proof in the paper we proved with Matt Hedrick and Albion Lawrence and Veronica. Let's see if I can do this. The challenge. But sorry. The question was, is it guaranteed that the restriction of this domain of dependence onto the boundary is indeed the domain of dependence of A? Which is what you would need for this story to be consistent. Okay. This is a significant test of my drawing skills, but let's see if I succeed. Okay. Okay, that's DA. It's wrapped around, it's half partial handkerchief on my boundary. This is E. DA is a shaded region. What happens is, for to get the domain of dependence of EA, so RA is this region on that slice. If you shine, you need to construct the region that you can sort of get by evolution in that domain, and you find that the light rays in the bulk may sort of intersect with each other and do all sorts of funny things. But the light rays that start out at dA, at the edge of the entangling extremal surface, make up the boundary domain of dependence. Okay? So it is true that this statement you can prove the statement, domain of dependence of RA restricted to the boundary of M is indeed domain of dependence of A. This works. And let me be even more ambitious now that this was not a disaster. See if I can get this right. And you can draw the corresponding picture for a complement. This is RA complement. So you have this butterfly picture in the bulk as well, where this extremal surface gives you DRA, DRA complement, the future of the extremal surface and the past of the extremal surface. That's pictorially what I wrote out there in formula. Okay, so let me leave it at that and mention in passing that the extremal surface is really, really special at this leading and subleading orders in that it gives you a decomposition of the bulk Hilbert space that is consistent with the boundary decomposition for the subregion A. No other surface that you might naively, this is not the only surface which will do it, but if you try to construct such surfaces using causal constructions, you will fail miserably. So I will leave it at that. Ask me what that means if you're interested. And now let me answer the question that I had earlier, which is, what happens if you have an obstruction in the bulk? And then pause to take questions and stop. So here's an example where you can have an obstruction in the bulk. So let me draw this on the Poincaré disk because it's nice to see. So here's my Poincaré disk, and here's my obstruction. I have a black hole. Okay? So there's a hole cut out of my space. So if A is small, there's some extremal surface that looks like that. Now, what is the surface for A complement? Well, for A complement, this is bigger region. So this was A. This is A complement. Well, there may be some surface that sort of comes back behind this side, because this guy is contractible back this way. It's not contractible back that way because it's obstructed by this hole. Now, there are special circumstances. For example, in four and higher dimensions, for large enough regions, such surface may not exist at all. Okay? So it's possible that if you look at a Schwarzschild black hole, we found that there are no such surfaces, so this doesn't exist. Now you seem like you're stuffed because this surface is not homologous to this region. But there's a surface that is, which is this guy union this guy. So, didn't say, but it's sort of, I said that the surface did not be unique. The surface also need not be connected. There's a disconnected surface whose satisfies all the properties. And there's a very curious fact that you can sort of see in this case that S of A complement, say minus S of A complement is a bigger guy, is S of rho for the total state. In other words, there are configurations which to leading order in the large C effective expansion saturate the Araki-Leib inequality. So if you haven't seen the Araki-Leib inequality, I should tell you that the Araki-Leib inequality says that S of A complement minus S of A is less than or equal to S of rho. And then there are lots of fun things you can do once you have this picture. Your problem sheet for this afternoon is to try to find various such surfaces for fun. Some of them you can do analytically, some of them you can do numerically, but many of them, all the examples I gave you today, you can do analytically. So everything that you've been hearing in the last 2 weeks, you should be able to work out starting from this basic story. And then there are fun things I would have done, like showing you how to leading order in C effective, you can give a demonstration that this construction satisfies the strong subadditivity inequality and derive inequalities of the kind that Patrick and Alex Maloney and Matt Hedrick and more recently the Caltech group have derived from holographic considerations by just playing around with this area formulae. Okay? So there are lots of interesting things, but I think I hope to have given you a sort of sense of what this is all about. And now you can just go away and read about it in various pieces of literature. Let me stop there.
So we already had many questions, but maybe we have time for the last one. OK. If not, let's thank Mukun again and go for lunch.